Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge. And welcome to Voice of the Cape Drive Time. In studio with me, I have a very special guest all the way from Turkey. But beyond that lies quite a big story. He's Mr. Abdullah Borskurt, who is author of a book entitled Turkey Interrupted, Democracy Derailed. He's also been a guest in the country of the Freedom of Expression Institute. He was bureau in chief for Zaman, which is was Turkey's biggest English daily based in Ankara. Unfortunately, this particular paper was seized on the 4th of March and Mr. Abdullah Borskurt was dismissed. He created his own media agency, but that was shut down too. Zaman is known to many people around the world because it was an English-speaking daily. Since the coup, I've been told 114 media outlets have been closed, including over 45 newspapers, 16 television channels, 23 radio stations, and 29 publicity houses. So what on earth is going on in Turkey? As one Turkish journalist said, I don't defend the Gulen movement, but yes, I do defend my profession. And yes, at Voice of the Cape, we are not Turkish, but of course, there has to be truth, because we believe facts are sacred. But, Mr. Abdullah Borskurt, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Drive Time.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, you've been on a very, very long journey, and we have so many questions to ask you. I almost don't know where to begin. But you've ended up in South Africa on something of an information tour. You used to work for a newspaper called Zaman. Just tell us very quickly about this particular newspaper.
Well, it was the largest circulated newspaper in the country, one time. And the government, especially President Erdogan, it was prime minister at the time, started targeting publicly the paper back in December 2013 when a massive corruption investigation exposed by the judiciary, which incriminated Erdogan himself, his family members, and his business and political associates. Like other critical and independent media outlets, we started covering from this investigation file, a massive amount of, facts coming out, like wiretaps, sanctioned by the courts, video footages, still shots that, money is handing over to the politicians. And we became a target, of course, by publishing these stories. And Erdogan, I remember very vividly, in the public rallies, attended by the tens of the thousands of the people, saying people not, don't buy this newspaper, put him in a trash, they are not credible whatsoever. We used to be credible when we were sort of supporting Erdogan, back in, 2002, when he engaged, democratic reforms, judiciary, rule of law as such. And at the time, our paper was selling 1.2 million copies on a daily basis in December 2013. After the attacks, we started losing some of our readers. It went up a little bit, like additional 200,000 after we started publishing investigation file from the corruption, because it generated a public interest. Mm-hmm. And after that, of course, the government campaign didn't stop, and we lost some of our readers. It went down to 800,000 next year. Some of the advertisers started pulling out the advertisement because they didn't want to get, government auditors next day. They don't want their licenses revoked, accounting books, dug by the investigators. But, our readers stood by. We still had, a formidable number of the readers that put our newspaper in the lead. At the time, as you said, in the beginning of the show, in March 4, 2016, when they finally seized the newspaper, we were selling 630,000 copies on a daily basis, mm-hmm. which was still the number one at the time. So that was the story. It was a mainstream newspaper. We were covering everything. We were very strong at the heartland of the country. That was one of our distinct characteristics, because most of the newspaper in Turkey, national ones, they concentrate on the big cities, on the metropolitan cities, because it costs less to distribute newspaper. If you go to the rural areas or other provinces, we have 81 in Turkey, then your cost goes up. And we decided, you know, way back, you know, the public deserve to receive the newspaper. So we set up our distribution network. We were able to send, you know, even the remote places in Turkey. I think that was one of the main reasons they targeted, you know, our daily. It's also sending quite a chilling message to the rest of the media. If you go after the big guys and, you know, punish them, then all the others fold in. They draw the line. And that's what has happened, unfortunately.
As a matter of interest, what was the nature of this corruption that you exposed? I believe it had something to do with oil sales and, of course, Syria as well. Am I correct?
No, it's not. You know, partially yes. In this story, there are some oil smuggling activity, but we were not the only one who exposed this. There are other critical newspaper and independent ones. They also publish, you know, from the leaks. The crux of the corruption is involves an Iranian guy. It's called Reza Zarrab. Who's sort of middleman for the Iranian government, especially for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. They were having huge difficulties in moving the funds around, you know, selling the oil in the black market because of the international sanction as well as the United States unilateral sanction. So they were using a guy like this, and there are others like Tajikistan and other countries as well, as a middleman to move the assets, to move the money, and to move the oil, you know, across the world. And for that to happen, of course, they need to tap into the Turkish financial system to make that happen. And without the government blessing, you couldn't do that because they are afraid, you know, your banks may be exposed. So this guy bribed Turkish ministers, and four ministers had to resign after this expose. But, you know, without the key man, the prime minister at the time, Erdogan, without knowing or blessing or sanctioning this, you know, bribes and the money moving around, it would be impossible to make that happen. And the investigation file is actually pointing fingers to him and his family members. There were lots of pictures, this guy, you know, standing in the VIP section with the President Erdogan or his ministers. And it involved, you know, millions of the dollars at the time. Another part of the corruption expose is also involved a Saudi guy. His name is Yasin Al-Qadi, which was listed at the time in the United Nations sanction list as well as the United States Treasury list as a specially designated, you know, Al-Qaeda financier. Both these guys watched by the Erdogan personally. He said these are philanthropist guys. These are the family, you know, members, family friends. So it was very clear from the beginning, actually, he's trying to protect these very, you know, controversial guys. And he didn't want this expose to move forward. I mean, he immediately sacked all the investigators, you know, police chiefs, the members of the judiciary, prosecutor, and the judges. They were dismissed, and they were later charged, actually, and put in the jail. The government started targeting individual journalists first, and that didn't work out. Then they came after the whole media outlets who were publishing these stories.
So yes, indeed, it certainly is quite a story. Let's get to the coup of the 15th of July, because I think everybody around the world is still scratching their heads as to who exactly were the people behind the coup. Have you got any ideas? Because the official line from Erdogan's government is it's the Gulenists who've become totally debased since July the 15th. He blames Sheikh Fethullah Gulen being the mastermind behind the coup. In your opinion, who started the coup? Where did it come from?
Well, we still do not have any idea. I mean, who actually masterminded this? Who are the key members of the, you know, the council that announced the takeover on July 15th? We have bits and pieces coming out of the investigation. And unfortunately, what happened was the government immediately get a gag order, you know, prohibiting the media from reporting any sort of leaks from the investigation file, or even criticism or interviews are banned as long as it's related with the coup investigation. So I mean, they're trying to cut off the information line to the public through the media by getting a gag order, media blackout from a partisan or friendly judge. So that makes it very difficult to understand what really happened, who actually, you know, instigated this. But my hunch is, and when I look at the names of the generals who were purged, some of whom are nationalist, leaning generals, some of whom Kemalists, you know, very status generals, and some probably, you know, have sympathy for Fethullah Gulen. So it's very difficult to rule out, you know, some that Gulenists are not involved at all. And nobody is denying that. But I mean, without the command blessing or the, you know, chain of the command, it would be very difficult and almost impossible to make a coup in Turkey within the military structure. And a lot of things are not adding up. For example, the President Erdogan, he got on the live TV several times trying to explain what happened on the night of the military, you know, failed coup attempt. And in four different occasions, he gave a different timeline when he first know about the attempt. Mm-hmm. So it's also confusing us. I mean, you are the main target of this, you know, attempt, and you are providing four different timeline. You know, one is said, well, at 4 o'clock, I knew I was alerted by my relative, and later he said it was, you know, 8 and 9:30. I remember it was a live TV interview, the last one. I guess they also panic about this confusion for the public. And he was in the last interview. He was reading from the paper. You could see from the television, mm-hmm. you know, footages. Mm-hmm. So that raises more question marks. And in all the past military coup attempts, the successful ones, the military was quite professional, actually. They did it in the middle of the night while people were sleeping. Everything was in place. By the time you wake up, everything is done and settled. But in this case, they do it in a prime time. It was like 10, and our national intelligence chief saying they knew the attempt at 4 p.m. So what happened between 4 and 10 p.m. At night? And there's lots of time where the government could intervene and stop all mm-hmm. this process. It's a speculation on my part, but my hunch is, you know, this was, I think, planned way in advance. Within the command structure, it was blessed by the force commanders and the chief of general staff. But for some reason, the government and intelligence, made aware of that, and they intervened. But the balls were already in place, so it was very difficult, probably, to stop all the balls rolling at the same time. So some of the troops probably went, you know, ahead with the action. But I mean, it still didn't make any sense. You know, why shut down the bridge? It doesn't make any sense. The first thing you do in any military coup attempt, you take out the political leadership. Then mm-hmm. It's very easy to control the police force, the intelligence, you know, and the government. They did not go, you know, they did not even arrest a single minister, cabinet minister. There are claims that this may be staged by Erdogan himself. We don't have a proof of that. But I mean, lots of circumstantial evidence suggests, you know, this is benefited Erdogan, because he said, you know, right away, this was a blessing from the God, and it turned out to be a blessing for him, because he engaged a huge purge. Maybe we'll discuss this further.
Indeed. And if you just tuned in, it's Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Our special guest is Mr. Abdullah Borskot, a former bureau chief for Zaman, which was one of the biggest newspapers in Turkey.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
If you just tuned in, it's Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Our special guest is Mr. Abdullah Borskot, a former bureau chief for Zaman, which was one of the biggest newspapers in Turkey, also published in English as well. Unfortunately, Mr. Borskot is now unemployed and doing a visit to South Africa. And of course, we started the interview talking about the media clampdown in Turkey. And this is basically the thrust of our interview. 114 media outlets closed, including 16 TV channels, 23 radio stations, and 29 publishing houses. So that certainly is something of a clampdown. Let's have a look. Let's just get some background quickly before you go to the other point you want to talk about. So many fingers being pointed at the Hizmet movement or the Fethullah Gulen movement. First of all, what is the background to this particular movement? I mean, we do know that Gulens, so-called, were a major part of Turkish society. How I understood it, you had people that supported Erdogan, you had your secularists or your Kemalists, as you call them, and then you had the Gulenists. So you had three major power blocks. It looks as if Erdogan is trying to wipe out one-third of Turkey in terms of power. But just give us some background.
Sure. This Muslim cleric living in the States in a self-exile for 15 years, quite an intellectual guy, very philosophical guy. He was part of the democratic base when this party came to the power in Turkey, led by Erdogan. And many people supported the ruling party, you know, liberals, independents, you know, even some secular segments of the society, because it came right after a major economic crisis in Turkey. So they swept into power in the first election. When he started becoming critical of Erdogan, I think even before the corruption scandal happened, on wrongdoings in the government, the abuse of the religious, narrative for the political expediency, Mr. Gulen became very vocal against not only Erdogan but others in the government, and he says this simply, you know, doesn't serve to the purposes of the, you know, Turkish democracy. It's actually hurting the religion itself. Because if you shift the debate from the religious base to the political narrative, then you're actually, you know, hurting the religious, you know, principles. I think the real divergence started back in 2011 when the Turkish government adopted a very strong, actually very meddlesome foreign policy with the Arab revolutions. Especially with the Syria, you know, arming the radical groups or opposition groups in Syria, trying to topple a regime there in the neighboring country and trying to replace with a sort of friendly proxy in the Damascus. I think Gulen at the time tried his best with a group of the Syrian clerics. For example, one of them, a very, very famous guy who was imam of the Emevi mosque in Damascus. I forgot his name, but very, very old guy, very respectable guy, born in Iraq. He sent a letter to him advising if this escalates into armed conflict, it will be a bloodshed and nobody will benefit out of it. And he trying to, Gulen tried to convince the government at the time not to engage this military option, you know, try, you know, further on the dialogue process, trying to find a political, you know, settlement to this brewing conflict. It didn't happen. And then, of course, when the corruption expose happened in Turkey by the judiciary, he also spoke very strongly against Erdogan and the government. He said, you know, whoever involved in this should be held accountable. So he became a foe, you know. He used to be a friend and ally to Erdogan, and later, because of his standing up against Erdogan on the governance issue, on the mistakes in the foreign policy, abuse of the religion for the political purposes, and a personal enrichment at the expense of the taxpayers, then he became enemy, in a number enemy, number one enemy in Turkey. And things, you know, got escalated from there. I think the main challenge in this story is Erdogan is sort of trying to position himself as a protector of the all Muslims, not only within Turkey, but outside of Turkey. When the corruption expose happened, it dealt a lethal blow to that, you know, ambition of Erdogan. Also, you know, Gulen's standing on, you know, on the religious principles, the Islamic values. It's kind of challenged Erdogan's narrative on the political Islamist base. So that's why he got very angry, you know, towards him, and he engaged this massive crackdown on the Gulenists in Turkey.
In fact, talking about anger, the Guardian newspaper writes that Turkey is currently at the mercy of one man's bad temper. That's a very strong statement, isn't it?
It is. I think, unfortunately, it's a true statement, because, you know, the checks and the balances is gone. and all the democratic institutions we have, like judiciary, you know, legislative powers and others, they simply collapse. And whatever he says or does, it becomes a policy without involving any stakeholders, either from the society or from the other government branches. And that becomes very dangerous, of course, because you are bound to make a mistake if you only rely on one man standing.
In fact, I think there's nearly 2,000 cases in Turkey of people in courts for, quote-unquote, insulting the president. So much for democracy.
Yeah, it was. I think the numbers is going up. This is also unprecedented because, yes, there was a book, there was a law in the book against, you know, defaming the president, but it wasn't exercised much, and the numbers were negligible for the past presidents. And all of a sudden, when Erdogan became a president after the prime minister's office, then these numbers started to go up. I mean, not just the journalists, even the, you know, ordinary citizens who are sort of tweeting critical statements about government or Erdogan, they were dragged to the court and immediately put, you know, behind bars. It's not just, you know, financial penalty, you also, you know, lose your freedom. This is also one of the benchmarks that we can measure how the democratic slide backwards, you know, moving in Turkey.
If you just tuned in, our special guest is Mr. Abdullah Boruskurt, a former bureau chief for Zaman, one of Turkey's best-known newspapers, highest-circulated newspapers, that has seized and shut down by Mr. Erdogan, and it has been apparently been reborn, but in another form, in a pro-government form.
Drive Time 91.3, always on the cutting edge.
If you just tuned in, our special guest is Mr. Abdullah Boruskurt, a former bureau chief for Zaman, one of Turkey's best-known newspapers, highest-circulated newspapers, that has been seized and shut down by Mr. Erdogan, and it has been apparently been reborn, but in another form, in a pro-government form. But of course, we're talking about the media crackdown in Turkey after the July 15 coup. Now, just very quickly, another question that a lot of South Africans that people have, we keep on bouncing back to Fethullah Gulen and the Hizmet movement. What is the Hizmet movement? I believe the word Hizmet in Turkey means to help or to aid people in socially. Just tell us quickly about the Hizmet movement and why would it be such a threat to Erdogan?
Well, it's a civic movement, a social group run by the volunteers. Everybody is involved in their own capacity. Some people just, you know, allocate their times, others financial donation. It's a purely volunteer-based organization. There is no command structure here. You know, if you believe in the, you know, modern science education, in addition to this, you know, some religious studies, then you invest, you know, in your own capacity, and nobody is forcing you to do so. One of the, you know, I think the main success in this Hizmet movement, I think, is education, because education empowers the people. It creates an upward mobility for the lower and the middle income families. If you look at the distribution of the schools in Turkey run by the, you know, people who are sort of affiliated with Gulen, they are all over. It's not just in the big mm-hmm. cities catering, you know, the rich and you know, better people. Even in the remote places of Turkey, you will see this school. Perhaps, you know, in some of the provinces, they are the only privately run school, providing, you know, a scholarship to the you know, poor families' kids, and they are creating opportunities for them, educational opportunities, and down the road, of course, better job opportunities. Another, I think, signature landmark part of this Hizmet movement is very much focused on the interfaith and intercultural dialogue. I think that's what we need, not only in Turkey but all over the world, mm-hmm. because especially after this radical movement sweeping across the Middle East from you know, so-called Islamic State and all kind of other radical groups, That's what we need. I mean, I think Hizmet movement is sort of provided a success story that people can relate and can be proud of. We have two, I think, challenging movements moving around in the Middle East and beyond. One is the Salafi base, which is sort of very close to the radicalizing the youth. And, you know, if you look at these terror groups in the Middle East, they are emerging or branching out from this ideology. So definitely something went wrong over there, and we need to look into that. And another, on the other side of the aisle is you know, very much politicized Shiite ideology backed by the Iranian government. So they are using and tapping on every Shiite minority, whether that will be in Pakistan or, you know, Bahrain and other places, not to support them, you know, against the injustices done by the host government, but rather trying to use them as a proxy in their political games. So these two conflicting ideologies are clashing against each other and putting people in a miserable position. And Hizmet movement is sort of put out, you know, there is an alternative way. I mean, you don't need to subscribe this, you know, radical ideologies or very much politicized ideologies. It may be a political ideology. It may be, you know, focusing on education, interfaith, cultural dialogue, you know, civic movement, you know, empowering the people and giving them the tools that can actually, you know, be replicated by the others in the world. I think that is very successful story, and Erdogan is, you know, hates that because he wants to politicize, you know, all the different religious sects in Turkey or the social groups in Turkey and beyond. You can see that, you know, a lot of conventions is being held in Turkey, people coming from different parts of the world and very much politicized religious figures, behind this government and Erdogan. So he wants to tap all these groups as a political support base. When Gulen and Hizmet movement refused to be part of that game, I think they became a villain and demonized by Erdogan in the public rallies.
Interesting stuff indeed. Let's get back to the clampdown in Turkey. I mean, the media has really borne the brunt of it. I mean, it's always a question of shoot the messenger, isn't it? But how much further, how much deeper has this clampdown by Erdogan gone? Because we're seeing stories of judges being removed from their positions, people in the army losing their jobs, people in the civil service, teachers being also losing their jobs. It really looks like a huge purge, and as you say, probably one of the biggest ones in Turkish history, including Ottoman history as well.
I think even in the world, I mean, I don't recall any historical reference to relate to this massive crackdown and persecution of the, you know, critical voices in Turkey. You're right, the media is getting brunt of it. I mean, just the numbers are quite staggering. 114 journalists are in jail as of today. Just to, you know, put a contrasting picture, last year, Committee to Protect Journalists, an advocacy group based in New York, I think, they published an annual report back in December 2015. In that report, it said all over the world, there were 199, almost 200 journalists are in jail. And Turkey at the time had only 14 journalists. Mm-hmm. And China was leading the pack with 49, Iran, Egypt, you know, all the notorious countries in terms of the jailing journalists. And today, if you look at the numbers, Turkey surpassed all the combined figures. I mean, it's unbelievable, 114 journalists. It was 102 when I landed in Johannesburg last Tuesday. Within a couple of days, it went up to 114. And the outlets that were shut down by the government, the media houses, 130. And that's amazing. I mean, Erdogan is trying to suffocate all the critical voices, independent voices in the media, so he can pursue his own project. You know, nobody could hear about, you know, 3,000 judges and the prosecutor losing their jobs, losing their assets because some of them put behind bars, and the government immediately moved to seize their assets. I mean, they cannot sell their houses, they cannot sell their cars, they cannot cannot touch their bank accounts. How could these people survive under the circumstances? So, I mean, there are no parallels in the history. I can relate. I mean, there are Holocaust issue. There are, you know, apartheid, which you know better than I. But this is unprecedented in Turkish history. I mean, unbelievable.
What I'm seeing coming out of all of this is massive polarization. In other words, you're either on one side or you're not. Either you're a Gulenist or you're not. People that I've spoken to are in Turkey right now say that Şefetel Gulen has become the devil incarnate. But at the moment, it looks as if Erdogan does, in fact, enjoy a lot of support. I mean, how are you seeing it? I'm not in Turkey, so I can't really comment, but just what I'm hearing is it seems as if Erdogan does have a lot of support, but I'm also seeing a lot of polarizations. Where is the truth?
Well, he does, because the government only hear one narrative, especially after you're shutting down, you know, you shut down all the critical and independent media outlets from the TV screens, from the print and all, you know, online media. You get only one story, which says, you know, Gulen is the number one enemy of the state. He is the terrorist. Not only him, but there are other foreign powers behind him, you know, not just Americans, you know, Gulf nations, you know, some African nations even, you know, mentioned. So, I mean, it's all kind of conspiracy theories fed to the public without providing a single evidence. It wasn't just related with a coup, especially after the corruption expose. Again, Erdogan accused Gulen, you know, he made him scapegoat, you know, behind this corruption investigation, but 3 years passed since that expose, and we haven't seen any single evidence to implicate Gulen in this investigation. It was part of the judicial investigation, but unfortunately, it was derailed and harshed up by Erdogan himself. So, I mean, it's not surprising to see that, you know, a lot of people in Turkey believe in that narrative and support Erdogan, because they see him as a liberator, he's the only guy who stood up against the West and the major powers, and is the only guy who can deliver the services. And as such, of course, part of the reason is the failure on the part of the opposition parties to present a challenging alternative. I mean, they are pretty much, you know, towing the line with the government and Erdogan, because they're also afraid, because so many of them are facing investigation in the opposition parties, and they are afraid of, you know, getting into jail on this, you know, trumped up charges. As for the polarization, you're right, it's not new, but it was deepened. The polarization is always there. There are division and fault lines in the society, not just across the conservative or the secular base, but Alevis, you know, the Kurds, and there are different. We are a very vibrant, diverse nation. And Erdogan, unfortunately, tap on this division, mobilize his own core supporters against others, you know, pitting them against each other. That's how he was able to survive in the past, and that's why he is doing this, you know, instead of reconciling the nation. I mean, look, the failed coup attempt provided a perfect opportunity for Erdogan and the government to mobilize the nation, and everybody was opposed, and all the media were opposed to the attempt. It doesn't matter who staged that. We don't want that. But instead of tapping this as a perfect opportunity to create a sort of reconciliation process, he rather opted for, you know, another road, and he deepened this division, and he started, you know, blaming others as well.
Of course, I mean, you've just mentioned the Kurds. We had a Kurdish delegation in studio about 2 weeks ago from the YPG. It was very interesting talking to them, because what they told us predominantly was, they said, number one, we want peace. And this is not the narrative we hear about the Kurds. Number two, they said, we want peace together with other people. And they said that the kind of peace we want is a democratic one, and it doesn't matter who is in our territory, it doesn't matter who we negotiate with, we want to have peace with everybody, a narrative that the world is simply not hearing. So why, for example, is Erdogan now bombing the Kurds in Turkey, particularly the YPG, and relating them to the PKK, when they're different organizations anyway? I mean, I'm a bit confused. Why is he bombing the Kurds in Syria, the very Kurds in Syria who are fighting ISIS and keeping Assad at bay as well?
Very good question. For one, the Turkey doesn't want to see an autonomous Kurdish, you know, region, and even independent one in the future in its border in, on the Syrian side. So they're trying to put a knife in that territory, sort of create a buffer zone between the two parts of the of the Syria. They don't want them to be merged and create a contiguous zone all the way to the Mediterranean. That's one of the reasons. I think another reason, Turkey invested a lot, especially Erdogan personally, on the opposition groups, some of them, you know, radical ones, maybe not ISIL, but you know, rather Ahrar-ı Sham and Nusra and some of the Al-Qaeda factions, financed and even armed by the Turkish government. So he doesn't want to lose that investment by going into this incursion in Syria, trying to protect the investment, pretending that he's, you know, battling against ISIL or other radical groups. When you have lots of network within Turkey, I mean, you are not cracking down on the ISIL networks in Turkey.
That's another question that came up.
Yeah, I mean, lots of them just rounded up, but they let him go from the other doors. It's like a revolving door we see. No real conviction that we have seen, because so many Turkish youth actually attracted to this radical ideology. They went over there fighting on the side of the radicals. And some of them came back and, you know, staged a terror acts in Turkey. So, I mean, it doesn't make any sense from the national security interests of Turkey either. With the Kurds, you need to find a political settlement, whether that will be in Syria, YPG, or whether in Turkey with the PKK. But, of course, some of the blame also goes to the PKK side, because they staged very bloody and violent acts in Turkey that not only killed the soldiers and the police officer, but a lot of civilians were killed in this major bombing attacks by the PKK. So I think the Kurds and the PKK, they have to make a decision whether they will pursue this, you know, settlement talks through peace or political means, or they will keep, you know, engaging the violent acts that will create that creates a lot of backlash in the rest of the country. So I think, but most of the, of course, this problem has been going on for the last three decades, and in many occasions, the Turkish government unfortunately chose to use military methods to try to resolve this conflict rather than pursuing a meaningful political settlement. We have seen two initiatives from Erdogan personally in the past, but all of them are related to the political, you know, expediency. When he saw the opportunity to tap into the Kurdish water base, he thought he used that, he resorted to that venue. When he thought there's a backlash from the Turkish nationalists, he just dumped the talks. I mean, you cannot do that. You need to have a comprehensive layout, roadmap to address this issue, and we haven't seen that, unfortunately.
Time really does fly. Mr. Abdullah Barskat, who is our guest, as I say, he's also the author of a book called Turkey Interrupted, Democracy Derailed. He's also a guest of the Freedom of Expression Institute in South Africa and was bureau chief for Zaman, one of the biggest dailies in Turkey, based in Ankara, but of course a nationwide publication. Our final question, where do you go from here? Because you are now actually in exile, and I don't think it's a secret that if you were to go back to Turkey, you would find yourself in a jail cell. So what's your future?
That's a good question, and I'm asking myself, you know, what to do next. I was reading a report the other day, how many, you know, self-exiled journalists were able to continue on their profession, and the number wasn't very promising. I think it was 13%, because it's difficult. I mean, you have been in this business for over 20 years, and all of a sudden you became unemployed. I mean, you're also very much afraid of going to the jail, and you're receiving death threats all the time from the social media, through email and others, and you find a safe haven in one of, you know, those countries in the West. Well, my priority is to be able to keep, you know, working on this field, to be able to keep speaking up, especially on behalf of my colleagues left behind. I'm the lucky one. So many of my colleagues didn't make it. You know, they were put in jail, and they were being harassed. And my family is with me, thank God. And some of my colleagues who are forced to live in exile, they are being harassed by, you know, by the government, directly to the family members. I know an editor-in-chief, for example, who fled the country and they arrested his wife. And his wife is in the jail for the last, I think, 3 weeks now. So it's unbelievable. I mean, the guilt by the association is being exercised by the government. But I am determined to keep my voice up, keep exposing the government's wrongdoings, whatever that may be, and to tell the world the truth. And also, trying to project a different and challenging alternative to the Turkish audience. That's what I'm hoping to do next.
Mr. Abdullah Boroskurt, has been a pleasure chatting to you. And as I said at the beginning of the interview, and these are the words of a well-known Turkish journalist, he said, "I don't defend the Gulenist movement necessarily, but I do defend my profession." And as I said at the beginning of the show, I'm sure you'll agree, facts are sacred.
Thank you very much. Of course I agree, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.